Welcome to Fire on the Prairie, the radio show brought to you by In These Times magazine.
On this show, Aaron Sarver interviews Howard Zinn, historian, writer, and activist. Zinn is author of the best-selling book, A People's History of the United States, and its new companion volume, Voices of a People's History of the United States.
We delude ourselves into thinking that if these people in high places only knew the truth, that they would change their policies. No, they wouldn't, because the truth is they don't care.
Also on this episode, listen to Emily Udell's interview with Marjane Satrapi, author and illustrator of the best-selling graphic memoirs Persepolis and Persepolis II. Satrapi has a new book out called Embroideries, which documents a group of Iranian women's humorous and revealing conversations about sex.
Finally, here Chicagoans respond to a recent Time magazine article's claim that Mayor Richard M. Daley is one of the top five mayors in the nation.
First up is an interview with Marjane Satrapi. Marjane Satrapi is author and illustrator of the best-selling graphic memoirs Persepolis, which documents her childhood in Iran during the Islamic Revolution, and Persepolis II, which recalls her young adulthood abroad and her subsequent return to Iran. Satrapi, who has lived in Paris for the last 11 years, just released a new graphic novel in the United States called Embroideries. Satrapi's new book portrays a group of her relatives, family, friends, and neighbors having a long, meandering conversation over tea. This clutch of dynamic Iranian women discuss love, marriage, and sex in a way that provides a fascinating and humorous window into the sexual politics and culture of Iran. Emily Udell caught up with Satrapi, who is visiting Chicago on a book tour for Embroideries.
Can you take me back to the moments that you first began thinking of the ideas and images for Embroideries?
It was just after Persepolis 1 and before Persepolis 2 when I realized that basically, you know, most of my work has been concentrated around whatever that was, war and the revolution and all of that. And that is a big part of the Iranian life that is based on the humor. And people, they love to sit, you know, to sit and talk and tell really funny stories and make fun of each other and make fun of other people. And really, that was really in this period that I thought that I wanted to write a book about also this part of Iran that you cannot so much see or taste in Persepolis, and that is where it started.
In Embroideries, you dispense with the panel format that you use more liberally in the Persepolis books. When multiple scenes happen on a page, they're not sectioned off in panels. Why did you choose this technique for this story?
Well, as I always say, you know, in a comic book, the images are part of the narration. They are not illustrations. So if you consider that these images, they are part of the writing. Of course, we're writing two different stories. You cannot write it in the same way. If you treat a very, for example, serious political subject, or if you take a women conversation, it's not the same thing. So, you know, a conversation is extremely fluid. That is what makes a difference between a conversation or a book, you know, with a long and heavy story. And I wanted that the form of the book would be actually as fluid as the conversation itself, to the image of the conversation. So I couldn't put any frame around, because a conversation is always open. You can always interrupt someone. You can always go, cut the story in the half, have it a little bit later. And I wanted the reader to feel the conversation, even in the way the book was made.
I have read that you consider yourself a humanist, not a feminist. But I did notice that Embroideries does encompass some of the current ambiguities in the feminist debate. In the story, for example, your grandmother says, in reference to embroidery, if people want to get sewn up, let them do it. And your aunt, on the other hand, says of her independent lifestyle, I'm accepted because I expect it. But this is also the aunt that had plastic surgery on her nose, if I'm not incorrect. So I'm just wondering, what is your perspective on some of these sort of ambiguities of perspective?
Well, you know, I like people just because they have this ambiguity. I don't like people when when they are like priests. You know, I don't like the preacher that they will tell you this is good, this is bad. I have never liked the preacher. I think everything is much more complex. So, you know, of course, the person who has remade the news and everything, she will say that she has to be accepted and respected and all of that. And my grandmother, who has never done that, you know, she doesn't care. The fact is that I don't have anything against feminists. This is not the thing. But is that, you know, there are so many things. I don't say that all the feminists, they are like that. But, you know, there are a group of them that, you know, they are like, whatever is bad in the world, they will say is very masculine, which is not true. I mean, if there is an evil, it's female and male at the same time. And after having seen, you know, what the American female soldier actually did in Iraq, you know, saying that we the women, there are things that we will never do and all of that. It's a matter of power. You give the powers to someone, they will use it. So that's why I believe in humanity.
This is Emily Udell. I'm speaking to Marjan Satrapi, author and illustrator of the new book Embroideries and also of the Persepolis books. What kept striking me about the book Embroideries is that it keeps coming back to the subversive power of laughter. And I thought, specifically, what better way to undermine the power of the patriarchy, as the women do in your book, than by making fun of the symbol at the center of it all, the penis? Can you speak a little bit about the rebellious power of humor in the lives of the women you portray?
Well, I think that in general, I mean, if there, that is one thing that let us live and go further and further, it is the humor. Because, you know, I mean, you can say everything by laughing, and you can say nothing by getting serious. As soon as you get serious, you have lost. It's always like that. And these women, of course, you know, they have lived in a very machist society, which doesn't mean that the men, they were bad or something like that. It's not what I'm saying, but, you know, it has been a society in which the woman, even though she was the chief of the family, she always had to pretend that that was the man who was the chief of the family. And so, you know, what you say is completely true. You know, nothing is more subversive than laughing. And nothing doesn't change the world as much as you laugh about it. And it's also, you know, this destiny of all these women, of all the generation. In, you know, if you see them from far, you have this feeling, these poor women, they don't have any rights and all of that, and they have been completely husband. And when you hear them talking, you say that they are not so much pushed down. And the men, they are not just as bad. That these women, they are just as nasty as the men they are. And that is something that I like more about it, that, you know, I have never seen any Iranian women to be a martyr or a kind of, you know, they are not weak people. I never considered myself as a weak person, never. I never thought of myself as being no one. And I never thought of my mother and my grandmother of being no one. They were real people. And they had the real character and the real power. And that is the way I see Iranian women. And I hate the way people, you know, outside, they talk about us. Like, oh, you poor miserable. We are not miserable at all. And that is also something that I wanted to show in the book.
Have people talked to you about that specifically, like when you've gone on book tours in the United States and in Europe, have people spoken to you about that specifically?
Yes, absolutely, because they say, oh, we didn't know that Iranian women, they were like that. I mean, listen, I have heard someone who told me, we didn't know that Iranian women had a sexual life. Can you believe that? I mean, the population of Iran has been doubled in 25 years. Just in order to reproduce yourself, you need to have a sexual life, even not to go further, you know. But, you know, the world is crazy, so anything can be possible.
I would imagine also that it would surprise some Americans specifically to see the candid sexual conversations that happen among multiple generations of Iranian women in your book.
Absolutely. I mean, especially in America when, you know, it's extremely Puritan as a culture. I mean, I have seen this, for example, this very young girls, you know, adolescent, that they told me in the school, instead of telling them how to have a safe sex and about pills and preservative and everything, they tell them, oh, the best way of not getting anything is not to do anything. I mean, how can you say this thing? An adolescent who is 16, 17 years old, the only thing they have in their mind is sex, 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 sex. They are guided by their hormonal problem. This is the fact. So instead of telling them, don't do it, when you know that they will do it, is to show them how to have it. The same thing is for the menopause women. As soon as you're over 50, then you don't have the right to talk about sex anymore because you are an old person, because we are living in this culture of youth that everybody has to look young and be performant and no wrinkles and all of that. So, of course, it's shocking for that for them because, first of all, it's a mixture of generation. It's not this culture of youth. People, they talk openly about it. They don't. It's not sinful. It's not disgusting. I mean, sex is not considered something bad. So, you know, it's a complete difference, you know. And when the American, they read that, it's like, oh, my God, you know, it makes them laugh. But at the same time, it's just enough that they would be a little bit conservative, that it would be, they will call that extremely subversive. And what you say just before is right. The laughter, the humor is subversive, but the book itself is not subversive. There's nothing subversive about this book. I mean, what is more natural than sex?
In the beginning of Embroidery, as your grandmother says, to speak behind others' backs is the ventilator of the heart. Is your work in some ways helping to ventilate your own heart?
Oh, my God, and I love to talk. I love the gossip, so you cannot imagine. Because when I gossip behind somebody's back, then I hate them much less. You know, because if I cannot say, for example, because I cannot go and say to someone, you know, you really piss me off, you know, and I think you're really, really ugly. Okay, but if I can say to a friend, just the fact of saying it makes this person make me less pissed off, and this person becomes less ugly to my eye. You know what I mean? It takes a little bit, you know, of all your anger away. So I love the gossiping. And I still have friends that call me from Iran telling me, and do you know what? And I love, you know, and because there's nothing serious about that, you know, it's really not that I want people to die or something bad. It's just a way of talking.
And do you feel like you express some of that through your work? Also, you were talking during the program about the woman that you lived with in Austria. And do you feel like that's part of how you ventilate your own heart?
Oh, yes, of course, of course. You know, I mean, I try not to solve my problem with people in my books, really. It's something that I really don't like. That's why, as I said, you know, most of the people in all the books, they don't have the real face and they don't have the real name. I really always change because, you know, maybe someone doesn't want to be in a story. I can completely understand and respect that. So nobody can recognize themselves really in Borders. The story, they are true. But then, you know, this is not the real name and none of that. But there are people like this lady of Austria. And I'm very happy with what I wrote about her. She was really mean, and I don't regret it one second.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me, Marjan.
Thank you very much, and you have a very nice haircut.
You just heard an interview with best-selling graphic novelist Marjan Satrapi, author and illustrator of the new book, Embroideries. Time magazine recently named Chicago Mayor Richard M. Daley one of the top five mayors in the nation. The article reads in part, "He is cozy with big business, is a master at the ward politics of fixing streetlights, and he speaks with a blunt, blue-collar brio that Chicagoans find endearing." Aaron Sarver visited the Damon Blue Line stop to survey Chicagoans on their opinion of Mayor Daley.
I don't know much about him except that he sort of legendarily seems to get whatever he wants.
No, I don't like the job he's doing, no. You know, I mean, the city is getting beautiful for those, you know what I'm saying? He is for those that have.
He's doing a great job. Yeah, I see a lot of improvement, and I think, yeah, he's doing good.
I think he's doing a great job. He's getting rid of all these gangs, and he's making these parks look better, the neighborhood look better. He's raising those rates of the houses where he could move those game beggars out to the south or something.
I think he's doing a pretty good job. Mm-hmm. Yeah, considering we have some pretty, well, I shouldn't say it.
You hear that he's done good things, like Millennium Park and downtown has become more vibrant and stuff. But I also know that he's very controversial. A lot of people, you know, I think he's kind of, you know, shady in some ways too and stuff like that. So I don't really have an opinion.
I don't have much experience of them. I haven't been here very long. I just noticed that his name is everywhere.
He's trying to, like, make it one of the greenest cities in the nation. So I think that's good.
There's always something associated with him that's scandalous in nature, corrupt, if you will. I don't know how he gets in office every single time, but, you know, whatever, you know. It's one of the most corrupt cities in the entire nation when it comes to politics, and it's really unfortunate, but what are you going to do?
Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States was first published in 1980 and has sold over 1 million copies to date. The book explores U.S. history from the perspective of working-class people, focusing on the struggles of regular people against the interests of the power elite. A People's History made Zinn one of America's foremost public intellectuals. He has the rare distinction of being lauded by the academic left and a seminal figure for activists. The recently published companion volume, Voices of a People's History of the United States, is composed of source material from A People's History. It consists of a wide variety of material, from anonymous sources and well-known figures, including John Brown, Sojourner Truth, Cesar Chavez, Adrian Rich, and Kurt Vonnegut. The book is what Daily Show host Jon Stewart calls gut-wrenching and never not interesting. Aaron Sarver recently spoke with Howard Zinn about Voices of a People's History and Zinn's life as a historian and activist.
Surely there are a lot of great essays and speeches that you had to leave out of the book. What was the process of choosing the pieces that you included?
Well, we did not want to choose the kind of documents that you find in traditional documentary histories. That is, we didn't want presidential speeches. We didn't want congressional enactments. We didn't want the Supreme Court decisions. We didn't want the material that normally appears in history books. We want the voices of people who are not famous, who are not in positions of authority, the voices of fugitive slaves, the voices of Native Americans, dissidents of all kinds. Most of these, or many of these, would be sort of obscure people, people not known. But on the other hand, it would also be people who are well known, but whose views on certain subjects are not well known. For instance, we chose Helen Keller, although Helen Keller is very well known, but she is taught in the schools as a, you know, person who was born blind and couldn't speak and hear and became very successful. But students are not told that Helen Keller was a radical, a socialist, an agitator against war. And so we include a speech by Helen Keller in 1916 called Strike Against War, which she delivers at Carnegie Hall, and this is on the eve of America's entrance into World War I. We also have something by Mark Twain, who, of course, Mark Twain is well known as a novelist, but most Americans, when they learn about Mark Twain, do not learn that he was a leader of the Anti-Imperialist League, that he protested against the war in the Philippines, that he denounced Theodore Roosevelt, because Roosevelt had congratulated an American general for committing a massacre at the Philippine Islands in 1906. We also wanted to include artists. We wanted to include poets, singers, and literature. So, you know, for instance, we have Langston Hughes, and we have Alice Walker, and we have songs by Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen, and we have excerpts from John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath and from Kurt Vonnegut. It's a very lively collection.
Any particular pieces and voices of a people's history that really stand out to you?
Let's see. Well, there's Las Casas blowing the whistle on Columbus. In fact, the book starts off that way. He is, you know, somebody not well known to most Americans. He's a priest who observed what the Spaniards were doing when Columbus and the others arrived here in the Bahamas, and he wrote several volumes describing the cruelties and the kidnappings and the mutilations that Columbus and his men engaged in order to get the Indians to find gold. You know, that is very striking. What stands out to me also are some of the letters of fugitive slaves who have been entreated by their former masters to return to slavery, believe it or not. And like the master will write to the escaped slave and say, hey, you know, why did you leave? I thought we were treating you well. We have a Reverend Logan, former slave, now minister in Syracuse, New York, and writes back to his former master, explains why he is not going to return to slavery. I think what stands out is the fact we have the voices of people right down to the present situation, right down to 9/11 and the so-called war on terrorism. We have a letter that was written by the Rodriguez family. They had lost a son in the Twin Towers on 9/11. And I write a letter to President Bush saying, our son would not want you to retaliate for his death by bombing another country and killing other innocent people. And so we include that letter. We have the statement by a GI who has been in Iraq and who is not going to go back. And he says, I refuse to fight this in Iraq and to kill people. This is a war for oil. These are some of the things that stand out to me, but there's so many. I mean, there are about 200 selections in this book.
Reading the book, I kept thinking how great it would be to have President Bush read the book and hear his thoughts on the individual pieces. Is there any specific person you would like to see pick up the book?
We have to find somebody to read it to Bush. He is not going to read it. And the truth is that Bush wouldn't care. We delude ourselves into thinking that if these people in high places only knew the truth, that they would change their policies. No, they wouldn't, because the truth is they don't care. And if their interests were the same as ours, then we might find common ground. But their interests are not the same. You know, Bush would not be moved by a mother appealing to him not to go to war. He believes in the war. So our hope is not that this will be read by the people in power. I hope this will be read by the average American who does not know these things and who will then organize and act and become part of a social movement that will then force the people in power to change their policies.
This is Fire on the Prairie. You're listening to Howard Zinn, author of the new book, Voices of a People's History of the United States.
Do you think that Voices of a People's History will reach an audience outside of the normal left crowd, or that you're mainly preaching to the converted, people who already read authors like Chomsky and Naomi Klein and yourself?
Of course, some of the people who buy and read Voices will be people who already, you know, sort of believe in the same things we do, but now, here's what I found in my experience with A People's History, which, you know, is my book which preceded the Voices book, and to which the Voices book is a companion. I found that the people who read the book, they may have agreed with me and with my point of view, they may not have, but they will very often then send the book to somebody they know, or maybe their parents, or maybe their friends, maybe somebody who they know has a different opinion than they do. One of the reasons that People's History in the United States circulated among so many people is because it did reach people who were not already sure of where they stood on these issues. And I'm hopeful that the Voices book will have the same effect.
What has been the reaction of other historians to your work?
The reaction of other historians really depends on the point of view of the historians. After all, my book is a book with a particular point of view. I very clearly and bluntly state what my point of view is. I say this is not going to be objective. History cannot be objective. History is always a selection out of an infinite amount of material, and the selection is according to what the historian thinks is important. And so I am going to write about what I think is important, the social struggles of people, the class structure in the United States, the racial problem, the problem of sexual equality, the problem of war. Those are the things that are going to guide me, you know, in writing this. Well, so it's a very, yes, an opinionated book, although I believe it's an opinionated book which is buttressed by historical fact. So those historians who are offended by this did not like the book. Historians have reacted to the book differently depending, you know, on where they stood politically.
You're very skeptical of the idea of objectivity. In the intro to the book, you write, quote, "But there is no such thing as a pure fact, innocent of interpretation. Behind every fact presented to the world by a teacher, writer, anyone, is judgment," end quote. Can you explain this a bit further?
Yes, when I say there's no such thing as simply a fact which is presented, because I say behind every fact there's a judgment, the judgment comes in deciding to present this fact. If a fact is presented to you, it's presented to you because the historian has selected this fact out of a huge number of facts that might be presented to you. And in presenting that fact, he's made a judgment. I mean, for instance, in presenting the fact about Columbus that he kidnapped and killed Indians, those are facts. But it required an act of judgment to decide to present those facts, just as to omit those facts, as most histories have done when they simply presented Columbus as an, you know, intrepid adventurer and so on, to leave out those facts. Those people could also just give facts and say, well, you know, Columbus sailed the ocean blue with three boats, and this is where he landed, and they could give you plenty of facts about Columbus, but if they leave out cruelties of Columbus, they have made a judgment, and so the facts they have selected represent a judgment, and that's true all through any kind of writing of history.
What do you hope the history books say about Howard Zinn?
I will appear in history books. I don't know. Of course, I hope that more and more historians will accept my ideas and look upon history in the same way and have the same values. And I hope they will say that I had an effect on the teaching of history and the writing of history and that I influenced people, this generation, in their thinking about the American society and about the world.
You've just heard author Howard Zinn talking about his new book, Voices of a People's History of the United States, and his life as a historian and activist.
Thanks for joining us for Fire on the Prairie. We'll be back again next month.
In the meantime, check out our website at fireontheprairie.com, where you can hear archived episodes, send us emails, check out our links, and get the latest news on the show.
Fire on the Prairie is brought to you by In These Times magazine and produced by Aaron Sarver and Emily Udell in Chicago.